Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for this hour of medical debate, dialogue, entertainment, education, and, well, whatever else might come along, including answers to your emails and calls. But before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers, and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It's not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Well, it seems pretty timely to be talking about Halloween, and if you're not scared about all of the issues around growing childhood obesity and the fact that the life expectancy of the current middle school generation is actually statistically less than that of their parents' generation, well, then you probably won't care about this story. But for those of you who do think that's an important issue, here's some suggestions for how to deal with the upcoming weekend and with, of course, Monday, which is Halloween. First of all, remember that tooth decay is still a big issue, and so getting your kids to brush their teeth after they've had their Halloween candy for the night, very good idea. But selection of Halloween candy can also be helpful if you haven't already finished buying, and many people are actually having to go back to the store and buy more Halloween candy because they bought it last week and ate it all. Those people who are still selecting, a suggestion to actually use dark chocolate as your Halloween gift that you give out. Turns out dark chocolate has a much better effect on the oral flora, and it doesn't cause nearly as much tooth decay as sticky treats like caramels or lollipops where you're just sitting in a sugar bath for hours and hours. Other suggestions for parents is feed the kids before you go out trick-or-treating. Give them a nice, nourishing meal and get those little tummies full. That way they won't chow down so much on the goodies as they're collecting them. Then when you get home, some psychological tips, lay out all the candy and count it, and then let the kids have maybe 10 pieces, their top 10 pieces, and let them eat several of those pieces, and then start negotiating. Some people buy the candy back from their kids for money. It's not such a bad idea as long as you don't necessarily eat it yourself. But many dentists around the country are actually collecting candy and sending it off to the troops in Iraq and Afghanistan or otherwise overseas. Some dentists will actually pay kids $1 per pound of Halloween candy. So if your kid had a big haul and you really don't want to keep it around the house, go to our website. We'll be posting a link to that on AskDrDawn.com, and you can turn that excess candy into cash and do something nice because, you know, if you're stuck out there at a military base, just getting a couple of Snickers bars from some kid who's sending their Halloween candy has got to make you feel good. First email comes from Denny in Shanghai, China. My 26-year-old son, who lives and works in Shanghai, has tested positive for H. pylori. His Chinese girlfriend has had many stomach disorders suggested of H. pylori, and you may know that it is much more prevalent in China than in the U.S., where we are from. Although my son has only minor symptoms, tenderness in his abdomen after eating sometimes, his doctor has recommended eradicating the H. pylori with a course of treatment with three powerful antibiotics. I've read the treatment is successful about 80% of the time in eradicating H. pylori, true. I also understand that it seriously disrupts gut flora 100% of the time, killing most of the healthy and benign microorganisms. Also true. As a big proponent of probiotics and probiotic yogurt, I wonder if probiotic bacteria like Bifido might help control the overgrowth of H. pylori and eliminate symptoms. Hate to call in an Agent Orange overflight just to kill a few weeds in the garden. Would greatly appreciate your thoughts. Well, Denny, thank you for a thoughtful question and a good setup here. First of all, it's very probable that your son will re-contact H. pylori, especially if his girlfriend has symptoms, because people who are in close proximity, particularly if they kiss or have other intimate household activities together, are commonly sharing the same strain of H. pylori when it's been studied. So we give it to each other as well. That means, just like when you're dealing with a sexually transmitted disease, you have to treat both partners in order to really get anywhere. Another thing that I would say is that the antibiotic therapy is really only indicated for people with active peptic ulcer disease. In order to heal the ulcer, you have to get rid of the bacteria. People who just have mild dyspepsia, who are in an H. pylori prevalent area, I don't think it makes a lot of sense to try and eradicate and keep it eradicated. There is a link between long-term infection with H. pylori and gastric cancer, but I want to emphasize that's long-term. So it might make more sense when you come back to the United States or he goes to live in Europe, eradicate it then. In the short run, I think it can be kept at bay with some natural elements. And so rather than trying to use probiotics to eradicate the H. pylori, my suggestion would be using oregano oil and berberine, which are two herbal antibacterial agents that are quite good at eliminating H. pylori. And if you do those in low levels, you keep the H. pylori perhaps not eradicated, but at least at bay. And you can give Bifidobacterium and Lactobacillus fermented foods to repopulate the gut. And essentially what good bacteria you kill with the oregano oil, you'll be replacing effectively with the probiotics. So at the current state of our knowledge, which is admittedly very primitive, it seems to me that a sort of suppress and re-inoculate strategy would be a more appropriate one. It was kind of a GI week. We have this email from MJ in Fort Bragg. Priority number one, thanks for your generosity, sharing your knowledge and skills through your wonderful radio program. Now for the whining. During the 10 plus years, 1997 to 2011, I was without insurance. My body decided it was a fun time to attack me and fall apart. I'm now 65, meaning now she has insurance. 5 years ago, I started experiencing diarrhea almost every time I ate anything. In 2000, I developed a constant case of acid reflux. Mid-1980s, my eye doctor told me I had no moisture in my tears and the outer layer of my eye was dried up and gone. And 2 years ago, my dentist gave me samples of biotin and I've used these products ever since. A short story long, between you and Google, I came up with celiac disease and classic Sjogren's symptoms that I can match to a T. The latest knowledge quest I'm on is to find out why most of the time the diarrhea cramping is just that, but occasionally I'm experiencing cramping with the diarrhea more like PMS. And I'm wondering about celiac disease. I hear it can affect pregnancy, but I've postmenopausal since I was 40. I read somewhere that TTGE cells do attach to the placenta. Okay, wow, lots of things there. First of all, celiac disease is a possibility. This is where you make antibodies to the intestinal wall, and diarrhea is one of the symptoms, also weight loss. And I think that you are more likely to have maybe gluten sensitivity, possibly. But given your reflux, I'm wondering if you might just have maldigestion. So in other words, many people in the sixth and seventh decade of life, and by the way, the sixth decade of life is when you're in your 50s, folks, have a loss of adequate amounts of digestive enzymes, and that includes hydrochloric acid. When a person has diarrhea and reflux, I always first think of they're not making enough hydrochloric acid. So I'd recommend hydrochloric acid supplementation and maybe some animal-based pancreatic enzymes and see if you do appropriate doses of that. You can find the appropriate doses on the bottle, but generally a couple capsules of each before meals, whether that attenuates the diarrhea. If that isn't helpful, you're welcome to email me back and we'll go to the next level. I'm not going to run down the whole thing because we have people waiting on the line. One last quick email, this from Sarah in Santa Cruz. My 68-year-old cousin was diagnosed recently with small intestinal bacterial overgrowth after testing positive on a hydrogen breast test. She's now completing a 2-week regimen of Xifaxan, and after she completes it, her doctors recommended taking probiotics. So, Dr. Don, what probiotic brands do you recommend, and where can they be obtained? I really like the Claire, that's K-L-A-I-R-E, brand of probiotics. They're very potent, and the people have done lots of research. They have targeted therapies, good website, and that website is protherainc.com, and that would be the best place to go. Claire Pro 5 probiotic would be my go-to regular use for her. Also, if you have SIBO, you should avoid taking lots of simple carbohydrates, so a diet high in protein and fat is important. But I had mentioned to the other caller about people's stomach acid going down. rather than just say, oh, you have the disease, let's treat it. Why don't we take another step back and say, you have this thing. Why is the ecology of your intestine such that bacteria from the colon can climb up in large numbers into the small intestine and thrive there? That doesn't make any sense. Something must be wrong with the environment that you're presenting. So let's fix the environment by adding more stomach acid. I think that will prevent recurrence. So products like betaine hydrochloride with doses of maybe 500 to 1,000 milligrams every meal would make a lot of sense for anyone with SIBO. And let's go to Vince in Santa Cruz. Hello, Vince, and welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Don. This is Vince. I'm a male, 58 years old, Scotts Valley. Family practitioner, my PSA tests have gone up over the last 3 years.
What numbers?
1.8, 2.6, and then 3. And this indicated to him I should have a PCA3 test.
Right.
Urologist, which I did go ahead and have. The DRE was fine, the digital rectal exam, and but I showed up positive on the PCA3 test at a 58. Anything over a 35, he said, would be positive.
Right, and PCA3 is a fairly good cancer marker. So we're putting you into, biopsy land.
Yes, that's what the urologist wants to do.
Yeah, and again, we're getting to, let's do the odds, do the numbers. If you were 68 or 78, I might say, especially if you were 78, even if you were really healthy, I'd say sit tight, don't do anything.
Right.
Because you're 58 and you have a life expectancy, aside from the possibility of prostate cancer anyway, you have this long life expectancy ahead of you, even with a long latency disease like prostate cancer, which might take 20 years to kill you, 20 years from now is still going to be shorter than your actual life expectancy, assuming that you're healthy. So I think you kind of have to get the biopsy and get a Gleason score and find out, number one, confirm you have cancer, and number two, if you do have it, is it aggressive or is it not aggressive?
And the biopsy would tell that?
Once you have cells, you can look at the number of mitotic bodies. That's how fast it's dividing. You can look at the number of chromosomes. You know, do the cells have the appropriate number of chromosomes, or are they messed up so badly that they've got, some have, instead of 46, some have, 52 chromosomes, in which case you've got a very aggressive tumor. And if your Gleason score is above 6, that's where you really start to see people dying from metastatic prostate cancer 5 years out, 10 years out from discovery. If the Gleason score is 3, that's an unaggressive tumor, and watchful waiting might be an appropriate move on that one.
Okay, great.
All right, good luck to you.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Don.
You're welcome. Yeah, and it's a Pandora's box. Recommendations are all over the map, and I've read them, and I've thought it through, and so just for all those guys out there wondering, should I or shouldn't I? You heard the logic there. If you're young enough to have a 20-year lifespan ahead of you, and it's a good probability you'll make that 20-plus-year lifespan, then yes, I would test. If you have a family history of some first-degree relative, father, second-degree relative, uncle, grandfather, dying of prostate cancer, then yes, I think you should. Once you get to the age where you probably won't live more than 10 years, no. So I stop in the late 70s. Early 70s is debatable. We talk about that. But I don't necessarily do prostate PSAs after 70 or in people who I feel have a short lifespan because I don't want to give them another diagnostic dilemma. And I just don't want to open Pandora's box and put them on that moving sidewalk to biopsy land unless I know that there's a good probability of benefit. Sometimes we do things because it's in the guidelines without really thinking and individualizing it. And lately, and this is one of my pet peeves, we're starting to get financial penalties as doctors for not actually going by the book. Now, that may be great if you're a middle manager and you're, getting a bonus because you've increased the percentage of breast cancer screening by 10%. But whether or not in the long run that's good for society or good, in fact, even for the individuals you're doing it to, needs to be looked at. And I'm sorry, I don't think consistency necessarily is a sign of quality. It's a sign of consistency. Okay, to our next caller, and that is Casey in Santa Cruz. Hello, Casey, and welcome to the program.
How you doing?
Oh, I am doing great. It's a beautiful day, and I got to dress up. So, yeah.
Wonderful.
I'm good. Yeah.
Okay. I've had a symptom for approximately a year and a half, and it has to do with the stomach, and you were on the topic of stomach.
We are.
It's an odd symptom, and it comes sometimes with food, but consistency, I like a martini, and consistently with the martini, if the first few sips of the martini, I'll feel my stomach burn, and I will get a distinct burning at the radial head on my left arm, just one-to-one.
You mean right at the elbow, yeah?
Right at the elbow, lateral side, and it's one-to-one. I drink it, I get the burning in the stomach, and I get the burning in the lateral aspect of the elbow. I've got a book, Francis Pottinger, Symptoms of Visceral Diseases. It doesn't list that symptom for a stomach condition. I know you have expertise in acupuncture. Is there any correlation in meridians or anything relative to that?
Thumb side of the elbow?
Okay, so lateral side.
Yeah, so that's the radial head. So yep. The thumb side of the elbow is on the large intestine meridian. That, you know, of course, is related to the intestines and related to digestion. The timing is a little odd. I don't know that chasing meridians is actually the way to go here. First of all, you get a burning sensation in your abdomen, in your chest. Where is
stomach? Yeah, in the abdomen. I can
upper abdomen.
You can,
yeah.
Yeah,
okay.
You can feel the liquid go down, and as soon as it reaches what I would say the stomach, it starts to burn.
Okay. So you have gastritis. Does it also happen with food?
It does with certain foods.
Got it.
Yes.
Okay. So you most likely have a gastritis, which is raw tissue at the lower esophageal sphincter, possibly above, possibly below in the antrum of the stomach. But either way, there's some inflammation there and some raw tissue, and the nerve endings are being exposed. Now, the nerve impulse travels through the splanchnic sensory beds to the spinal column, and from there starts to head up the spinal column, and it's going to join up with the nerves that go down to the elbow. Now, it's possible that you're getting crosstalk actually in the spinal column, and this is a phenomenon for those of us who are old enough to remember copper phone lines. You would sometimes hear distantly a conversation over your phone line due to improper shielding of the individual copper carrying your talking versus the next, literally the next conversation in the cable. That sort of thing can happen in the spinal column, and I would be feeling that was a bit more likely, that your spinal thalamic tract was getting some crosstalk from blending of these two signals, and so your brain is getting essentially a signal as if it were coming from the elbow, but that signal's actually originating in the stomach. If it were on your stomach meridian, which, in other words, if the outside part of your knee was hurting right away, then I would say, okay, that's pretty acupuncture-y. But it's a great question. Thank you. I think what you should try now is using a coating agent, something like deglycerized licorice. You can pick that up at a health food store, or something over-the-counter like Maalox or Mylanta, and get yourself a big dose of that, and then drink your martini and see if you ameliorate the effect or attenuate it. If you do, then what that says is, okay, I have raw area. Now, maybe it's not just one martini. Maybe it's, sometimes three or four. I'm not maligning you. I'm just saying if that were your circumstance, you may actually have an alcohol-induced gastritis and you need to heal that up for a while. You know, go on the wagon, maybe do 10 days of proton pump inhibitors, get it healed up, and then test with some orange juice or something acidy before you go back to your previous habits.
You know, they say after three or four sips, I don't get it anymore.
That's
the stomach does not burn.
That isn't impressive. That's common, actually.
Okay.
So you get the pain initially, and then it sort of stimulates some protective measures, and then it gets better.
Okay, and then could it be related to a bacteria in that I used to... last year I had a really big garden, and I used to go out and graze, and I didn't wash the food before. I ate beans and different things. Could it be related to some bacterial component in there?
The answer to a could it be question in medicine is almost always yes.
Okay.
It's possible. It's not likely.
Okay.
And even if it were, the advice wouldn't change.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
First, you do the test and figure out, do I actually have gastritis? And from there, you try to heal it. If you can't heal it, then we get into, you know, treating H. pylori or looking for H. pylori and stuff like that.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks.
Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Mm-hmm.
There was a big splash in the news about daily aspirin cutting colorectal cancer in high-risk adults, made major news stories and headlines. The people who told me about it completely misinterpreted the article. I didn't actually read the newspaper article. I went straight to the source, and this was a paper published in Lancet, which is a very respected British medical journal. I like reading The Lancet, actually, because it has a social consciousness and often thinks about things like, is this a meaningful change for the population, rather than just saying, oh, new product, how cool, which is more how the New England Journal of Medicine is. Anyway, back to the story. Lynch syndrome is a hereditary disease in which people have a mutation in a repair gene for their DNA. So you can think about all those little cells dividing constantly in your body, and then they're having to duplicate their DNA, rather like monks in a monastery. Sometimes there's a mistake made, or I like to use the analogy of a Xerox that you Xerox, and eventually the letters O, A, and E get really hard to tell apart, and you start to make transcription errors. So people who have this DNA repair gene mutation are going to develop colorectal cancer at a rate of 4 out of 5 of them. So 80% will eventually get cancer. This makes them a nice group to study if you've got 3 to 5 years only and not, say, 15 to 30 years, and you'd actually like to have a paper that you can publish at the end of the time. And that's essentially the situation here. They gave 600 milligrams of aspirin to 800 individuals with Lynch syndrome. They monitored them for up to 4 years, and the groups separated in terms of cancer rates. But again, we're getting into statistical significance, not statistical significance. They had to diddle the data a little bit to reach statistical significance by counting not just people who get cancer, but the number of cancers the people get. So their statistical significance initially was not statistically significant in terms of the number of people in the aspirin group who got cancer versus the number of people in the placebo group. Then they said, well, what if we go back to the group that got cancer and we give them a point for every cancer they had, because many of these individuals show up with several cancers in their intestines, not just one. So if you gave them a score, one for each cancer, then you could make it statistically significant. This is kind of cheating, and we've been talking about cheating with statistics, but does this matter? The real question is, if it's being discussed all over the country, front page news, doesn't matter. And unless you have Lynch syndrome, we really don't know if it matters. There's some data from the Women's Health Initiative showing that long-term use of non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, not specifically aspirin, has a lower colon cancer risk. And, you know, I think there's statistical and epidemiological studies that do suggest that NSAIDs are beneficial in terms of lowering the probability of cancer. The problem with NSAIDs is that they're gastric irritants, and there can be other consequences for long-term use. So these studies don't really look at that. At this point, I think the baby aspirin a day keeps a lot of things away. Data is decent, and I don't think a baby aspirin a day is dangerous enough to worry about. But the doses used in this study, 600 milligrams a day, are definitely enough to damage the intestinal integrity, lead to ulcers and GI bleeding. And I don't think we want to do that as a recommendation unless we can show that there is a good benefit that outweighs these known risks. And I don't think we're there yet on this. So thumbs down for the way that this was presented in the media. But of course, you've heard that from me before. Anne in Pacific Grove writes, I found that aspartame in sugarless gum and sugarless Tums makes my ears ring. I've started and stopped them a couple of times, and my ears no longer ring when I stop. The ENT I went to see said it had no effect, but that's not my experience. My friend gave me sugarless xylitol gum without aspartame from Whole Foods, and I have no tinnitus from it. I enjoy your show very much. Thanks for doing it. No need to reply, but I thought you might share this on the air. And that is interesting. I have never had a patient report that before, but you've done the appropriate thing, which is the start and then re-challenge and then repeat. And if you have effect with an agent and you stop the agent, the effect goes away. You re-challenge, it comes back, then repeat that whole thing. So two challenges and two resolutions, then at that point, it's doing it to you. Now, why could this be happening in Anne's case? I think may have to do with glutamate, because aspartame raises glutamate levels. That glutamate can have a stimulating effect. It's an excitatory neurotransmitter directly in the central nervous system. And it's possible that in Anne's case, her damaged hair cells, or in other words, the damaged nerve cells in her ear are being stimulated, and that stimulation leads to the production of a sound. Not much you can do about that except avoid glutamate and aspartame. But also, by the way, glutamine and glutamate are two completely different things. One does not turn into the other. So those of you who are using glutamine for health purposes, don't worry that you have to stop. This from Jack in Seneca Falls, New York. I'm getting up 4 to 5 times a night to pass large quantities of urine. I'm on a 0.5 gram daily sodium diet that I comply with carefully. I also take 10 milligrams of phenylephrine to help control my blood pressure. This often leaves me lightheaded, and I'm not getting adequate sleep from getting up so often in the night. I think Jack's a fall risk here. Would it be possible to safely replace the phenylephrine with a diuretic to help me urinate more during the daytime? I'm 66, 5'8", and I weigh about 140 pounds. Thanks. Well, Jack, first of all, I do think it would be possible to replace your phenylephrine with a diuretic, and I'm concerned about the lightheadedness. I hope that you'll get a blood pressure cuff and monitor your blood pressure after you've been standing for, say, 5 minutes. It may be that you really do need to change agents. Certainly a diuretic is possible. You might pee a lot during the day and have less urination at night. The other thing I wanted to mention is you've got to get checked for diabetes, both the mellitus variety and a rarer kind of diabetes where people don't have the ability to concentrate their urine. You could call it kidney failure, although it's not kidney failure. It's from a central nervous system defect in making a hormone. But either way, the result is lots and lots of urination. So I would collect some of that copious urine you're passing at night, take it to the doctor, have them check the specific gravity and see if it's not concentrating. You always have to worry when a person is passing large amounts of urine at night. Small amounts, well, that's just having a prostate and being an older man, but large amounts is definitely getting my attention. Our next caller is Lily in Monterey. Hello, Lily, and welcome to the program.
Thank you. I have had a problem over the last few years of when I get a cold, then I'm getting over the cold, but I'll get bronchitis, and I don't like to use antibiotics. I was just wondering if there was an alternative so that right now I can feel it in my throat. What can I do to avoid
it going into bronchitis? Well,
right.
First of all, most people don't realize that majority of bronchitis is viral, not bacterial. So that's just FYI. Certain viruses have an affinity for the upper respiratory tract. Certain viruses love the lower respiratory tract and always get down there in everybody. Others are kind of, well, it depends on the host defenses. And based on what you're telling me, you have an impairment in your host defenses. So at the first sign of a cold or sniffles or respiratory infection, I would start with zinc. And the zinc is zinc picolinate. It's been shown, particularly in lozenges, if you suck on the lozenges, it helps slow down the reproduction of the virus. And that's the kind of thing you're trying to do. If you slow down the reproduction of the virus, then it allows your immune system to get the upper hand and keep it from not going down into your throat. Washing out your sinuses at night before you go to bed with a neti pot, salt water lavage, might help reduce the amount of virus that is raining down into your trachea and bronchioles. And that could be beneficial in terms of reducing the inoculum and therefore hopefully helping protect the lower respiratory tract. There are all kinds of people who walk around with what you're describing who actually have mild asthma and don't realize it. And so what they're calling bronchitis is actually the virus kicking off a little bit of asthma. That can be figured out by doing pulmonary function testing, and the next time you go to the doctor, you might ask to be checked for that, because that is a possibility.
Right.
Okay?
Okay.
All right. Good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. And this was an interesting tidbit that caught my attention, and it kind of makes sense. When people have mild Alzheimer's disease, they're less able to process. They may be able to follow their old habits, get up, brush their teeth, shower, get dressed, go down and make some toast, but you wouldn't necessarily want to have them balancing their own checkbook. For people in that level of Alzheimer's, a recent study shows that there's a statistically significant improvement if you just remove any cataracts. Average age 85, 38 patients, all showing mild dementia. And after cataract surgery, there was a significant improvement in about 25% of them in terms of their functioning. And they were tested at 1 and 3 months after cataract surgery, and the improvement in functioning did hold. The depression was also relieved. This is really interesting. Other studies have shown that the sleep-regulating hormone melatonin gets disrupted in individuals with cataracts. So when you take the cataracts out, the sleep cycle restores itself. Melatonin levels rise at night, and so you get rid of some of the nighttime wandering behavior that makes people with Alzheimer's such a management issue. Let's go to Jan in Santa Cruz. Hello, Jan. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you. I have a 70-year-old aunt. This is another question about SIBO. I'll give you a quick intro and then one or two questions.
Okay.
You asked about, you know, why does she have SIBO? Slow motility, GERD, which is now being under control by Aspheric. She 3 years ago, she had Barrett's esophagus. Mm-hmm. She's treated and is now clear. At one time, she was on as many as 4 Aspheric, 20 milligrams a day. She's now on 1, and it's controlled. She has the SIBO. She's been treated, or she's in the process of being treated. Your information about the probiotics was good. The question is, well, 2 questions. 1, you recommended more stomach acid.
Yes.
And for somebody who has GERD, how would you address that? And 2, do you have any good source, a good resource for how to treat SIBO? She's looked on the web. I've helped her. There are some good sites that mention diet and a number of other things. But do you have anything, a book or anything that you would recommend for people who do have SIBO?
Small intestinal bacterial overgrowth is one of the entities that is, how shall I say this? It used to reside entirely in the arcane high-level textbooks and in alternative land, and has recently been coming through the internet into people's consciousness. Symptoms of SIBO include belching and bloating right after meals. And what is going on functionally is that food that has been partially digested is hitting the small intestine, where ordinarily there are only small numbers of fermenting bacteria. When there are large numbers, they grab the carbohydrates, short chains of sugar, basically, and starch, and ferment them and produce gas as a byproduct. So the more bacteria and the higher they are, the sooner after eating you have bloating. Mm-hmm. So this is what people manifest with. Unfortunately, your aunt is really between a rock and a hard place. The conventional wisdom there is, yes, because of the Barrett's, she has to remain on a proton pump inhibitor forever. The problem with that is that without that gastric acid at the front end, keeping the SIBO from recurring is going to be extremely difficult. And you probably will have to continue to use some sort of antibacterial agent constantly. And so you're going to be challenging the intestinal tract with an antibacterial, hopefully an herbal one, but you might end up having to use even low doses or frequent doses of Xifaxam or something else. It depends on how it goes. But you're going to have disrupted flora forever because you can't restore a normal situation without the normal situation in the first place. Mm-hmm. And you've created for her, because of fears of esophageal cancer, essentially what's been done is a therapeutic abnormal situation is now in place.
Right.
And no one will have the huevitas to stop the proton pump inhibitor, because if she gets cancer, that would be, you know, malpractice.
Mm-hmm.
So I would recommend using the stomach acid with meals because you need some stomach acid to digest your food properly. And paradoxically, and it's counterintuitive, and I can't help that, it often improves GERD symptoms to give acid. As long as the person doesn't actually have gastritis or raw tissue and you've gotten it healed, the presence of acid in the stomach speeds gastric emptying. And the longer your stomach digests, sits there with the liquid chyme in it, the more reflux you're capable of having. If you can get the emptying occurring, it actually tends to improve reflux. When you empty, you are going to have sterilized more effectively what you're eating and broken it down a little bit further. That helps a lot with the SIBO. Now, in terms of a book, I don't have a specific book I can recommend. I'm sorry about that, but I don't. Where you may want to start is just using the literature. And so going to scholar.google and searching on SIBO and looking at studies. There's probably review articles. There may be a best practices out there in the gastroenterology literature that I'm not aware of. And that would be the place to start. But I do think that it's going to require ongoing support. I would say if one betaine hydrochloride gives her pain, then she's still got raw tissue down there, and that's worth knowing all by itself.
Okay, that's very helpful.
I'm glad.
Okay, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Kira in Monterey. Hello, Kira. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Dr. Dawn, and thank you for your wonderful show.
Well, thank you.
I have two questions for you. Recently, I went to the Student Health Service because I have no health insurance and my Medicare starts January 1st. And the doctor took my blood pressure, and it was a little bit high, but she was more concerned about my heart rate, which is in the 90s. It sort of varies between the low, high 80s and 100, around 100. And she thought this was way too high, and she was concerned and that I should go on a beta blocker. So my questions are, what's the significance of having a heart rate that goes at those numbers? And what can I do about bringing it down if it is dangerous to have a heart rate like that? That does not involve medication. Are there things I can do? And why is this very dangerous to have a heart rate that high?
Well, I think very dangerous is an exaggeration. Start with that. What we know about this is that there's this thing called sympathetic tone, which is run by adrenaline. Your nervous system has this kind of tug of war going between the sympathetic and the parasympathetic nervous systems, and they are essentially the stop and go signals for heart rate, digestive rate, the amount of blood that's flowing to the extremities versus flowing to the intestines, all sorts of other physiologic things. Your bladder function, for example, are tied in with this tug of war between these two yin-yang-like influences. So that's the basic dynamic of all of your involuntary functioning. And if a person has too much adrenaline, they will tend to have a higher blood pressure and a faster heart rate. So that would be, by inference, your situation. The non-drug way to fix that is, I'm in the kitchen. It's really, really, really hot by the stove. Let's take a step, a giant step back from the stove. So what are the stressors in your life? What are the things that are upsetting or challenging, and this could be good challenge or bad challenge. What are those things that keep you on alert all the time? Take stock of that, and then which ones can you get rid of so that you can spend an hour every day in a state of peaceful bliss and not on alert, you know, hanging out in the hammock, so to speak, metaphorically. Think about a kitty cat, okay? You've got the kitty cat lying on a sunny windowsill, awake, purring, practically made of liquid. You know, when you see a cat, they're so relaxed. Now think of that kitty cat with a threat. Suddenly the back is arched, the hair is standing on end, it's going, you know, and completely different. Same cat, but just completely different manifestation of energy. Well, you want to be more kitty on a windowsill than you're being right now. Finding out your inner kitty on the windowsill is something that there are a gazillion self-help books and classes and things that will help you reduce your stress. So that's what you need to do first.
I think that's very accurate because I'm super type A, hypervigilant, worries about everything, always anticipating everything. And I think that maybe I do have too much adrenaline. So yeah. Meditation, yoga, things like that.
Right. And you have to practice it. It's not like, I'm telling this because you're the type A person, so don't be impatient. You actually have to learn how to do this and learn how to evoke the relaxation response and then practice it. And then once you get good at it, all sorts of good things happen. Now, other things for bringing down blood pressure, make sure you're getting plenty of magnesium, at least 1,000 milligrams a day of magnesium. Make sure that you are walking a half an hour a day, getting at least that level of exercise. There's evidence that a diet high in fruits and vegetables reduces blood pressure. And all of these things will bring down the blood pressure and bring down the heart rate. The other thing is learn to check your own pulse. Because if you are able to do that, that gives you the power to assess yourself. You know, after doing the meditation, check your pulse. Are you down to 70? Good. You did it right. Now you know that. You just got off the phone and you're feeling funny. Check your pulse. Oh my goodness, it's 105. That was a toxic conversation. Can I get that person out of my life that I was just talking to? And maybe you can't. But the point is, if you can't get rid of a toxin or an evil influence or whatever you want to call a stressor, then what you do is you arm yourself ahead of time. If I know that when I'm talking to my mother-in-law, it sends my pulse rate up 15 points, well then before I talk to my mother-in-law, I go meditate so that I'm starting at 70.
So that's further to go.
Yeah, so I only get up to 85. And by the way, when you do that, you don't get up to 85 because you've already armed yourself against the reaction. It's been shown in lots and lots of conditioning studies that you can actually desensitize yourself from your stressors by engaging in this sort of, well, what should we call it? Proactive relaxation rather than reactive relaxation.
Proactive relaxation. I'm going to write that down. Can I just ask one quick question about magnesium glycinate? I take 400 milligrams, so I should probably practically triple that. But why do we take my magnesium glycinate instead of like milk of magnesia? Because milk of magnesia is really cheap.
Ah, yes. Milk of magnesia, however, will not absorb past the intestinal tract, which is why it makes such an excellent laxative. It won't get into your bloodstream where you need it.
Okay, thank you. That's very helpful.
All right.
This is extremely helpful in terms of things, actions I can take.
Well, good. Good. That's my goal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's talk to Sarah in Carmel. Hello, Sarah. Welcome to the
Hello.
Program. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello. I really appreciate your holistic approach because I try very hard not to take medication. Morning mucus. You just heard that. It's been recommended that I use the Medipot.
Yes.
But I find that sometimes it causes a great deal of pain. Goes up the nose toward the eye and then along to the top and back of my head, and it's very painful.
So you haven't got the pH or the acidity of the thing you're using correct, or it's too concentrated. So it's too much salt or the pH is wrong. You need to be sure that you're measuring the liquid you're using. You don't use plain water. Okay, so anything that's either too concentrated or not concentrated enough will cause irritation. And that's just the nerve that's being stimulated and you're feeling the effect of that.
You say don't use plain water.
Right, don't use plain water in a neti pot. You have to use a salt solution.
I see. Oh, I do use a salt solution. I actually bought a special salt at one time at the Whole Foods store.
Yeah, but I think that the concentration is off.
I follow the directions.
That the concentration is off.
For me, as an individual.
Yeah.
Are you suggesting I use less?
Well, I think you'll have to play in both directions, but most likely if it's an immediate discomfort, I would use a lower concentration, maybe dilute it a bit. And maybe just use a sea salt concentration with a pinch of bicarb, and you can find recipes all over the internet for getting to physiologic saline. And that's really what I would try to do, is just sea salt and a little bicarb, make up your own, and see if you're still getting a problem. Is it both nostrils?
Sometimes it is. It's usually the one on the left.
Okay, because if it's ever both nostrils, then it's not just a sore in your nose that you're hitting. It was always on the left side. The other thing that consider would be that you have a sore or a cut or a raw area that's persisting and that's being t- touched and triggering off a nerve impulse. But if you ever get it on the opposite side, then I think that's much less likely.
Okay, but it's not dangerous in any way.
It's not dangerous, it's just uncomfortable, and we want to make sure you're comfortable.
I see. I also, a long time ago, was diagnosed with asthma at the same time that I had a cold of some kind, and I don't have many symptoms of asthma, but occasionally I do have difficulty breathing, and you did mention something about a previous caller that
that's
it could
right.
be asthma.
That's right, because some people with asthma don't wheeze, they just cough and get tight and have trouble breathing. And it's easily discoverable when you do breathing testing or spirometry testing. If you have ever been diagnosed with asthma in connection with a respiratory illness, you have to consider yourself at risk for that happening again. But many people have had one or two episodes of quote-unquote asthma or reactive airway disease with a respiratory infection, and that's it. So it's not a chronic disease, and you shouldn't be labeled as such.
I see. Okay, but it wouldn't matter if I did have asthma to use the neti pot.
No. In fact, I have my people with an asthma use neti pots to reduce the amount of allergens in their nose and also the chemicals that our own body releases when it confronts something it's allergic to themselves tend to trigger worsening asthma.
I see. Is it ever possible for the water to go up into where it feels like it's going?
Yes. I mean, when you use a neti pot, the water is supposed to fill your nasal passageways and actually move across the foramen and into the opposite side. And that it's supposed to do that so that it washes out all of this accumulated dust, pollen, and the chemicals I've been speaking of.
But I meant that going straight instead of going across, instead of going out, it feels like it's going vertically.
Well, that means it's getting into your frontal sinus, which is not a bad thing. But if it's painful, then, like I said, you want to figure out why it's painful. And my first suspicion is the concentration or the ingredients in the solution you're using.
Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I really appreciate your help.
Bye-bye. Good luck.
Bye.
Let's go to Phil in Los Gatos. Hello, Phil.
Wondering if you knew of any dogs in the Bay Area that could sniff feces for colon cancer?
I am not aware of anybody who is offering that as a diagnostic test at this point, a dog-agnostic test maybe, but it will probably come. It's still in the research phase, so I can't help you there. But have you tried searching it to see if there's any clinical studies or anything? That might be the better way to go.
Yeah.
If you go to the clinicaltrials.gov website, and then search on it, you might find somebody at Berkeley or UC doing that work who have dogs. So you might be able to find it that way.
Okay, I'm just trying to avoid my second colonoscopy.
Oh, well, I have a suggestion for you there. There is a pretty good DNA test now. It's not routinely offered to patients because we're having trouble getting the insurance companies to pay for it,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, go figure. But I guess the idea is we have to pay for the colonoscopy anyway. So we don't want to buy ourselves more colonoscopies by paying $200 to, you know, find cancer early. I don't understand the logic. But anyway, it's about a $200 to $300 test, and it is available. Quest Diagnostics offers it. It looks at a range of SNPs, bits of DNA, rather, not SNPs, that are only seen or elaborated in the presence of a cancer. So there's certain protein products that are made by colon cancer cells, but they're not made by normal colon cells. If you see those, then you have to worry. And that would be a decent substitute. Do you have a strong family history for colon cancer?
No.
The other alternative, and I offer this to many of my patients, is just do annual FIT cards or FICASHER, which are two trade names. These are an immunologic test for blood, so fewer false positives than the old GWIAC cards. If you do three of those cards every year and they're all negative for blood, you do that annually, after 10 years, the survivor rate, the case-finding rate is the same for that versus colonoscopy. But I want to emphasize you have to do it annually or you don't equate to colonoscopy unless you actually do it every year. But if you do it every year and they're always negative, statistically it's the same as getting a colonoscopy every 10 years.
And what is the test called again?
There are two. One is FICASHER, F-E-C-A, ASHURE, and then F-I-T. Capitals, and these are the immune stool blood tests. So they're immunologically based, not chemical based.
Okay. And one other question, not related.
Sure.
But for the shingles vaccine, is it still just like about a 50% viability?
Well, no, that's not what it is. The shingles vaccine lowers your probability of getting shingles after the vaccine by 50% compared to a control group that did not receive the vaccine. So that's where they separate. It's in the future. So it's a fully effective vaccine in the sense that you do get antibody, but whether or not that antibody is sufficient to head off an attack of shingles, it's only 50% effective in that endpoint.
Okay. Has a second generation come about that's more effective?
No. Nope.
So do you recommend those?
I leave it up to people. I also have to point out that it's a $200 vaccine, and if you are having trouble buying groceries, I think it's not worth it. Your risk of getting shingles as an elder is, you know, somewhere around 1 in 20, and so you're going to take it to 1 in 40, and it's going to really break the budget that month. To me, that's not making much sense.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for your information.
And thank you for your call. Have a wonderful day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Well, we've used up the hour, I think, quite well. I hope you've enjoyed the program as much as I have. I know that I'll be back here next week, and I hope you'll be back here to join me. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long, and stay healthy.